right, well, we'll make a start. Thanks very much for attending today. I know it's a little bit outside of the regular schedule, the regular end of semester schedule. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker today, who's also going to be a keynote at the Australasian Society of Continental Philosophy Conference in Auckland, which starts on Wednesday. So we're very happy to have Associate Professor Nicholas Kompanis to present our talk today. He's visiting professor at the Department of Political Science and the Centre for Ethics at the University of Toronto. And he will be presenting a paper today entitled Reason, Reflective Disclosure and Democratic Politics. So thanks very much.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. I've always wanted to come to this part of the world, but until Robert made an offer I couldn't refuse, I never had the... Do we have to do this, Chris? Okay.
You'll forget it.
Okay, I will. Try to ignore what he's doing. It's not important or significant for our purposes, though for his it is. What was I saying? Yes, so being here is a very special occasion for me. And so to begin my talk, I wanted to do something before I do anything else, which is to bring this little thing over. Can I move this over, Robert?
Yeah, sure.
Because it will come in handy later. Okay, so I'm assuming you know nothing about me, and so I'm going to say a couple of things about this paper, or these two talks, which are not meant as written papers, they're meant for oral presentation. They are trying to stitch together work that I have done to work that I'm in the process of doing. So I wrote a book that will be some of you will be discussing later on critical theory and a different conception of practical reason, different conception of the practice of critique or social criticism. And since completing that book, I am now writing two other books, one of which is a contribution to democratic theory, which tries to rethink what the object of democratic politics should be. I'll come to this later on in my talk, but it's a move away from models of democratic politics based on theories of public deliberation, the Rawls-Habermas family of theories in that domain, and also it's a move away from the vision of democratic politics put forward by someone like Axel Honneth and Nancy Fraser, in which recognition is a primary or the primary framework for democratic politics. I'm working on another conception of democratic politics altogether, which grows from that book I mentioned, but is moving somewhere else at the same time. And another book, which is a book on philosophy of music, which picks up again something from the critique and disclosure book, and that is the centrality of receptivity. So it's really a theory of receptivity or receptive agency. Some of this you will hear going on in both of these papers, some more than others, but it's the background for these two talks. The actual talk of the paper is the disunity of reason, reflective disclosure, and democratic politics. So the point of the paper is to offer an alternative standpoint, rather an alternative point of embarkation for democratic politics, where if you're still committed to some version of reason playing a central role in democracy, whatever that version may be, you would think of reason differently. And instead of thinking that somehow reason, writ large, is, so to speak, instance as one and the same reason in every form of rationality or every instance of reasoning or reason giving, instead of thinking of reason as one and the same across its various applications, that idea we owe to Kant, whom more later. What if we think of reason not as unified, but as essentially disunified, that when we're dealing with reason in its various instances, we are not dealing with reason that is one and the same, but heterogeneous forms of reason or heterogeneous forms of practical reason. And therefore, we would be taking on ourselves a far greater burden in terms of understanding the reasons of others, where the greater burden isn't simply to translate their reasons into our home language, but rather will require us to learn the language game of reason giving or reason practices that is not translatable into ours, not sufficiently. And so it's an it's an attempt to say we don't already understand or are not in a position already to translate those reasons of others, which we confront daily in a multinational, multi-ethnic, pluralistic society or pluralistic world, or integrated pluralistic cultures of the kind we now live in. So that's the embarkation point. What if reason isn't unified, as Kant and post-Kantians like Rawls and Habermas believe it is, not in the constitutive sense of unified, but in the regulative sense, right, as an ideal, that there is ideally some underlying unity, because you could never demonstrate that unity as a constitutive unity. It's not, that would be an error, a metaphysical error in Kant's sense. So let me begin and read some of this, and then there's a kind of cut in the talk where I move to a related talk and bring up some questions which I think you will want to bring up as you're listening to me present some of these crazy ideas I have in here. And I try to answer some of those questions and then raise some more new ones which will preserve your sense that what I'm doing is a little bit crazy and nuts, and so you will have lots of questions to ask nonetheless, even though I may have answered a few of them for you, but not satisfactorily. So, neo-Kantian political philosophers like Rawls and Habermas presume the unity of reason and develop their normative theories of practical reason on the basis of this presumption. Moreover, the presumption of underlying unity fosters a certain faith in the power of reason to reconcile the conflicting interests, values, and worldviews that clash within and between contemporary democracies, rather violently at times, as we see every day. Ha. Now, this is especially true of Habermas, who has written at length about the unity of reason, not as something that can be grasped as a totality or as a constitutive unity, but as something reflected in, quote, the plurality of its voices, unquote. Its unity, he writes, becomes perceptible as the possibility in principle of passing from one language into another. This possibility of mutual understanding, which is now guaranteed only procedurally and is realized only transitorily, forms the background for the existing diversity of those who encounter one another, even when they fail to understand each other. So reason in it, the idea is that the unity of reason guarantees that we will understand one another eventually, even if ever so ephemerally, because this unity is of a procedural nature or character. It's about how it is we come to understand one another, and the various hows all share one thing in common, they're procedural. As Habermas avers, the regulative unity of reason has this procedural but not substantive existence. Its unity is guaranteed in and by the rationality of its procedures across its diverse employments, be they, as Habermas distinguishes, between They're pragmatic, theoretical, and practical or moral practical employment of reason. So these are the procedures, these procedures are the ones used in trying to solve problems, be they the empirical or theoretical problems with which the sciences must deal, or the moral practical problems with which citizens of democratic societies must grapple. To understand the unity of reason in this way is to understand that, quote, what counts as rational across all of the diverse applications of reason is solving problems successfully through procedurally suitable dealings with reality. So moral practical problems, you have some version of the categorical imperative as the normative procedure for solving problems, or its more contemporary forms, Habermas's universalization principle, or Rawls's veil of ignorance, and there are, you know, various others. So I have argued at great length in that other book against the severe limitations of this procedural conception of reason. In what follows, I want to make the case for the disunity of reason, which I should confess is a bit modeled on Ian Hacking's writings on the disunity of science. Ian Hacking was my teacher at the University of Toronto some years ago. And so, arguing for the disunity of reason in the belief that beginning from the presumption of disunity is far more valuable and advantageous to democratic politics than is the presumption of unity. Eventually, I will say something about the need to reorient democratic politics around practices of what I call reflective disclosure, rather than around a single correct normative procedure set thereof, which would bind us all, the silver bullet with which we could suitably deal and solve all the problems of highly complex and deeply pluralistic societies, problems that would be otherwise intractable. Before I get into all that, I want to identify and dramatize, to borrow the language of William Connolly, a flashpoint of disunity at the heart of Habermas's formulation of reason's procedural unity. And I'm going to do the same with Kant in a few minutes. The flashpoint occurs in this formulation I quoted above, precisely when Habermas writes of the possibility in principle of passing from one language into another. Construing this possibility procedurally as a guarantee against radical incommensurability, Habermas fails to see that the possibility of passing from one language to another cannot be guaranteed by any procedure. There is no guarantee that I will understand you when you speak differently from me. No procedure will provide me some kind of epistemic guarantee that you will be intelligible to me, you will become intelligible to me. From the perspective of the speaker who is trying to pass from one language to another, the passage is always from an old and familiar language to a new and strange one. In order to negotiate such passages, there can be no procedures to be followed, no rules that would guarantee success, even occasional success. There is no procedurally suitable way to deal either with the recognition that the language we currently speak is not all the language that we need, or with the passage from an old and familiar language game to a new and strange one. If there were such procedures or rules that could be followed, there couldn't in principle be anything new or strange or unfamiliar. There couldn't be anything new to learn, to make sense of, anything new to challenge us or transform us. What opens up the passageways between languages is not any procedures, but certain practical abilities of agents, not least important of which is a receptivity and openness to the new and strange. These passageways do not and cannot pre-exist the back and forth movement, from old to new by which they are first opened up. So let me put it this way. The distinction I'm drawing here is like the distinction between translation from one language to another and learning a new language. Translation doesn't require us to learn a new language. We find a way of putting the terms of the foreign language into our domestic one, putting the terms of the unfamiliar into the more familiar terms by which we make sense of things, assess things, and so on. Translation means that our language, the translation model, which is Habermas's model, it's the model which this conception of reason as unified implicitly assumes, is a model in which our home language will always be a language which is semantically rich enough to incorporate any new terms, any new language in a way that doesn't require us to become speakers of another language. Alternatively, if we think of the encounter between the old and the new, not as an encounter that requires translation of the new into the old, but as something that requires acquiring a new language, because our current language is not going to be able to translate what is new into our familiar terms, so we have to become speakers of a new language. Now, some of this is also tied up to the idea that when we are giving reasons, we are always giving reason in a style of reasoning, about which Ian Hacking has written quite a bit, a style of reasoning which makes those reasons intelligible in the first place. There are styles of reasoning such that the reasons offered in those styles, right, to become intelligible as reasons, we have to reason in that style. So, in science, there's lots of examples, the Newtonian style, right, very different. I mean, for us to make sense of that, we have to use that language versus the language of quantum metaphysics. That also applies across the diversity of human cultures. To understand why X thinks Y, it's not enough to take X's reasons as already intelligible to us, let alone cogent. We have to think in that style of reasoning. That doesn't mean that when we move from one style to another, we're like moving in discrete, discrete ETE languages that do not connect to one another. We're not in a relativistic universe of some kind of multiple languages, none of which can communicate with one another. It's not a notion of language or language game here that is a closed system, but an open, porous, semantically open, porous system. Nonetheless, though there can be movement between these languages, being a speaker of both is different from just translating the one to the other. I mean, it's a common experience for anyone learning a new language. You go and study German in Germany or Chinese in China, you find out translation doesn't work. There's a way of life with which this language goes, and certain items only make sense when that is understood and grasped. Somebody who comes from North America and starts driving a car over here finds out right away that it's the other way around and you're on the other side of the street. So one thing you can tell yourself is, well, this is a simple case of translation. The driving's the same, right? Except I'm doing the driving on the right-hand side of the car and I'm driving on the left-hand side of the road instead of the right-hand side of the road. So it's just a matter of flipping everything around, right? I'm looking at the mirror here. The rearview mirror is there, not there. And so it should be straightforward, but it isn't. Even though it's just a flip, it's a completely different experience. And in fact, I'm told people have done studies that shows the brain gets rewired if you are going to drive successfully from the other side of the car. So you find that out immediately when you look in the rearview mirror and realize that even though it's looking this way instead of that way, it's a different kind of looking. Everything changes. You really are learning to drive the car anew, not from the ground up, but in some very basic ways. We notice in practice, rather than in theory, that some things that look like straightforwardly translatable are in fact not. It's a different way of driving. It's a different experience on the road. It's a different relationship to the vehicle. So much for this little bit of homemade phenomenology. But I think even in the cases where we think it's straightforward, it isn't. And of course, in the more dramatic cases where we know the other guy's talking nonsense, or it sounds like nonsense to us, and we couldn't possibly assess things this way, or we don't have those things in our world. They don't show up in our world. In those instances where it's much more dramatic, it's clearly the case that if there's going to be any hope at all of intelligibility between different language games, different cultures, there has to be something besides translation. There has to be some process, some activity of learning the other person's language. Okay. So we cannot approach then the transition from an old to a new language in a suitably procedural manner, because coming to adopt a new way of speaking and acting involves a process of learning that is neither familiar nor controllable, which is why every time someone, an adult, for example, goes to some other country to learn a new language, you feel completely infantilized, because all of a sudden you have to start speaking at the stage of speaking you were at when you were 2-3 years old. And it's one of the most humiliating experiences you can have. Some adults find it so humiliating they can't endure it. They'd rather not speak the language than be constantly humiliated. I've seen people break down and cry in Germany when, you know, they were going to buy something from the market and they said, you know, something the wrong way, and the Germans just look at you like you're a Martian and have no reason to be accepted on Earth. And, you know, there is this humiliating, infantilizing experience because we have no control over our agency at that point. We are reduced to being primitive speakers of a language. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. If you speak, you have to speak with these 10 words you have and this primitive understanding you have, but as an adult. And that is hard. That's hard to endure, to accept as the state you are in. Right? We don't normally find that very comforting or comfortable. So, if that then is indeed the case, if we're speaking about a process that is neither familiar nor controllable, is there any rationality to speak of here? Because we don't think of reason or rationality in terms of what is unfamiliar and uncontrollable. Rather, we think of it as quite the opposite, that rationality gives us a control over the situation rather than a loss of it. So how can something that is uncontrollable and unfamiliar possess the attributes of reason or of rationality? Well, if your picture of rationality is procedure, the answer would have to be no. If, on the other hand, you are no longer held captive by this picture, the answer could be yes. If it could be yes, it means the rationality that is involved or manifested in this activity of opening up passageways between languages that don't already speak to one another is heterogeneous to procedural rationality. It does not involve anything like procedures or rules, and hence not unifiable with such a form of rationality. It would also expose the procedural unity of reason as just one complex of practices of reason, or just one complex of rationality, rather than that which unifies all the various applications and practices of reason, and so would not exhaust the meaning of reason or its possibilities. In my view, it is a picture of reason, this procedural picture, that needlessly and all too successfully obscures, distorts practices of reason which can't even be imagined by those held captive to it. Which is one of the reasons why they find the domain of art, culture, and certain types of politics as simply derivative forms of rationality or not really lying within the ambit of the rational. So this is the next part of the paper that concerns the way Kant grasped the disunity of reason, even though he is really the go-to guy for the conception of reason's unity as a procedural unity. This proceduralist picture of reason is, of course, a very old image of reason in which it is indissociably associated or identified with rule or rules or law. No one has been more effective in powerfully entrenching this identification of reason with law than Kant. But Kant, bless his soul, contrary to established opinion, is also the great disunifier reason of reason, for it is Kant who first disidentified reason from rule and law on one side and from knowledge on the other. Kant disunifies reason in two steps, though he would not think of this as what he's up to. This is what I read him as being up to. In the first step, he sharply distinguishes between reason understood as die Vernunft, the faculty of ideas, from reason understood as der Verstand, the understanding, which is grounded in empirical knowledge. Reason and knowledge are, in a sense, split apart. There is, of course, something you learn in your first Kant course, that in the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant opened up this huge gulf between freedom and nature. That is, the human being understood as part of the natural world, as an object to be understood as any other objects in the natural world, and the human being as essentially free and must presumed to be free, which is has this transcendental status. It has no empirical status. But he didn't just open up a gap between freedom and nature. He opened up a gap between reason and knowledge. A huge gap. I'll come to that in a second. So there's a distinction between reason as a faculty of ideas which have no empirical object, or which are not connected to anything in the empirical world which to which they could correspond, and reason as a rule-governed and the rule-governed acquisition and exercise of knowledge by which we solve problems in a procedurally suitable way. So Kant writes in the first critique, as pure self-activity, reason is elevated even above the understanding, even above our straightforward understanding of what rationality is, which has a direct connection to knowledge. Can't think of rationality as somehow disconnected from knowledge. Any exercise of that rationality would be considered irrational if it didn't involve a correct application of knowledge. But here we have Kant writing that it reason in this radically new sense, which we never came across before in the history of Western philosophy, and this radically new sense is elevated even above the understanding or procedural rationality with respect to ideas. For with respect to ideas, reason shows itself to be such a pure spontaneity that it far transcends anything which sensibility can provide it. Right? So the idea is that reason is so, in this sense, is so tightly connected to freedom, understood as the spontaneous exercise of our agency, that there's nothing out there in the world, nothing that we already know or in our experience, that can capture this activity, that can translate it. So, a little aside here. So I said there's this rift in reason, rift between reason and knowledge. So we have this traditional textbook Kant version where we have nature here, and freedom there. But on this reading of the disunity of reason I'm giving, this rift also goes down to a rift between knowledge or experience, right? That which is the object of rationality in the conventional sense, and reason in this new sense, which is connected to a conception of freedom as a spontaneous, normatively creative agency. Kant writes also in the first critique that reason is connected to the power of freedom to pass beyond any and every limit. Reason, in this new sense, is transgressive. And some of you have probably read or have been exposed to Michel Foucault's famous essay, What is Enlightenment?, where Foucault goes to great lengths to distinguish a conception of critique with which he credits Kant, that is, a critique of reason where what the critique does is to draw out the limits of reason. Limits reason must not transgress, otherwise it will make fundamental errors, cause metaphysical illusions, bring about metaphysical illusions. If we constrain reason to work within its proper limits, then it can generate principles by which we can investigate nature and principles which can, in the practical domain, order our normative lives. But here, and so Foucault says, but we need a form of critique that is transgressive, that doesn't just respect limits, but transgresses them. Well, Kant already said it. Okay, on my reading on this disunifying Kant, this romantic crazy Kant that I favor, which makes me a very poor Kant scholar, and I acknowledge that. I'm not a good Kant scholar. I'm more of a thief, kind of guy who goes into a storeroom in the night or a museum, steals stuff he can use. On this view, then, reason is already transgressive, for it does not respect these limits. So if you're going to have this view of freedom as passing beyond any and every limit, right? Now, the limits we're thinking about here are not necessarily epistemic of an epistemological kind. We're thinking about, and here's the other thing that we want to put up here. We're thinking about political and moral limits. So it's the difference between what is and what ought to be, right? And so the ought for me in Kant is about possibility. That what reason does here is to disclose or open up or propose new ends, possible ways of going on with our practices, which even though they may have no connection really to the way we currently understand and do things, insofar as they are practical possibilities indicating a way to move on that passes beyond the limits of our current practices, then they can be confirmed in some future. They have a relation not to the present, to what is, but to a possible future. So critique then, and reason in this sense, being internally connected to this concept of freedom as a spontaneous normative agency, does not just observe limits, as most Kantians believe, but transgresses them. And that's because reason is the faculty of ideas, as he calls it. And ideas are concepts which have no corresponding object in the world. They are, so reason in this sense, in my language, is a world disclosing agency. It opens up alternative possibilities for us to carry on our practices towards and with. And this, I think, helps to get another sense of a famous remark made by Kant in the critique, the first critique. Nothing indeed can be more injurious or more unworthy of the philosopher than the vulgar appeal to so-called experience. Now, he's not just thinking of Locke here. He's saying that if we begin from what is, from what we know, then we are giving up the whole domain of the ought, the whole domain of possibility, really our whole orientation to a future which is different from the present or past we have known. The past or what we know from experience cannot be a guide to human beings or beings such as us. That's why vulgar. German use a word like vulgar. It carries a lot of weight. So the idea then is reason is a future-oriented and future-dependent, that is, the kinds of claims reason makes cannot be the kinds of claims that are going to be verified by something out in the world. They're not like propositions, which can be tested, yes or no, right or wrong, because, damn it, the thing being claimed doesn't really exist yet. And if it is to exist, it will depend on its being able to convince us, or this claim will have to be argued for in some way, such that we want to see it become true, rather than something that is or is not true now, is or is not right now. Okay, so going on. So with this novel reformulation of reason, as I said, it's reconfigured as a normatively creative agency, proposing ends that go beyond what is already given empirically or normatively, possessing the power, as Kant writes elsewhere in the first critique, to create a new normative order, an entirely new normative order, by disclosing alternative possibilities to the current one. And it owes its power, this power, and here we come to the second step in the process of disunification, to its spontaneous freedom to initiate a new beginning, a new series of causes and effects about which she talks in the closing pages of the first critique. Thus, reason is newly identified with the freedom of new beginnings, and it is just this very notion of freedom that Hannah Arendt had in mind, in which she described an absolutely pure Kantian terms, as the freedom to call something into being, quoting Arendt, which did not exist before. Right? We're talking about an idea which has a vision, a possibility, a practical possibility, which has no place in our current language game. It has there's nothing out there which it can correspond to. The freedom then to call something into being which did not exist before, which was not given, that is, given to the senses, not even as an object of cognition or imagination, and which therefore, strictly speaking, could not be known. This rift I'm talking about between knowledge and reason, between knowledge and this employment of ideas or disclosure of possibilities which do not really correspond to anything in the world today, and therefore cannot be known, cannot be judged in the usual ways we know and judge things. So, going now to the next part of my talk, which is heading now in the direction of the meaning of all this for democratic politics, if it has any meaning. So if we cannot begin from the presumption of the unity of reason, how do things look when we begin from the presumption of its disunity? And how could that be more rather advantageous to democratic politics than beginning from the presumption of unity? First, if we do begin from this presumption, we will become more attentive or sensitive to the problem of how to negotiate and live with the fact of heterogeneous rationalities, or the fact of deep pluralism. Rather than presuming some underlying unity, regulative or otherwise, which can guarantee safe passage from one language of rationality to another, we would have to recognize the need to create new passageways, or thinking more institutionally, that our current political institutions cannot do what we need them to do. We cannot rest content with reforming them or fixing them up or making them do things better than they do. We need a different kind of institution, because in this sense, then they would still be translating rather than, we still have language political institutions that translate rather than learn new languages. So we'd have to recognize the need to create new passageways and to proceed knowing that there can be no guarantee of success. That, of course, means acknowledging the insufficiency of our preferred language of rationality and argument, our preferred vocabulary of description and evaluation. It would also mean acknowledging that breakdowns and crises of various kinds are inherent and inescapable features of human forms of life, and that we cannot order matters in such a way as to preclude these breakdowns and crises, as though once we set our normative house in order, we would never have to again begin anew. Most importantly for my purposes would be the acknowledgement that we cannot rely on argument as it is conventionally understood as the only primary and only trustworthy medium of practical reason. A procedural conception of practical reason places argument in a position of cognitive superiority to the activities of interpretation and to narrative practices, and excludes as practices of reason the practices which allow us to acquire new tongues to say what could not be said and new ears to hear what could not be heard. It assumes, as Habermas is committed to assuming, that the only kind of cognition that counts as definitive for practical reason is a practice of justification geared to the recognition of universal validity claims or universal truth claims. But what a deficient mode of cognition is argument construed procedurally and practiced as a form of competition in which the best argument wins, in theory, if not in practice. Let me say something. From Habermas, I worked with Habermas in Frankfurt as a doctoral and postdoctoral student, our fellow. And the one thing I've retained from Habermas is that reason, in any sense of reason, is connected to learning. But then, what is learning? What counts as learning? What learning processes do we think to be the most rational or the fullest embodiment of reason understood in its fullest, richest sense? Throughout his theoretical writings, Habermas has always had difficulty finding a place for those kinds of learning processes, which actually change us, which really bite into us and transform us. Argument does not do that. Convention, what we're doing here, we don't walk away different people when we walk away from an argument at a philosophical conference or what we're doing here. Not that this is invaluable because of that. This is an important activity. Otherwise, why are we doing it, right? It's obviously means a lot to us that we can argue and argue well, make sense of the claims we're making, and try to convince others that they are decent claims, if not wonderful. Okay, but it's not an activity that cuts deep into the kinds of learning processes that allow us to see things in a new way. So we can let that go as a kind of, some weird thing that happens that involves the imagination or processes which we can't control, which it certainly does. It doesn't involve processes we can control. But the question is, do we want to give that up? or do we want to rethink what reason is in terms of just those learning processes that have the greatest potential to change or transform us? So that's why I say, what a deficient mode of learning is argument understood the way philosophers understand argument. Because when we go and argue, we're trying to win something. We're trying to beat the other guy. We're trying to get attention for our claims. We don't want to be changed. We want to tell someone the way things really are with this text or that problem. And then we give reasons for it. And when we're partially successful, they go, yeah, I see your point. And maybe I'll try, you know, let's rethink what I'm doing in terms of what you're doing. That's pretty good, I think, right? When you get to be the kind of person that makes somebody else rethink the way they're thinking about things, that's a pretty major achievement in philosophy or in academic life. But the kinds of change we need in order to get along with one another and stop killing one another, stop mistreating one another, involve something else. And it can't be that. So the whole point of this argument language game, which of course only a philosopher would put at the center of democratic politics, only philosophers, and we have been, you know, involved in the definition of democracy from the outset, although not only us. We forget about the Greek tragedians who were also involved, but we'll come to that another time. It's not an accident that argument is placed at the center of democratic politics. But unfortunately, the whole point of this language game is to convince your interlocutor that you are right under certain demanding conditions of justifying your claims to be right. But this public competition for better arguments, as Habermas puts it, a public competition for better arguments. Is this public competition for better arguments the most promising medium of democratic politics, given the irreducibility of reasonable disagreement, and the deep pluralism which surrounds us and separates us as well? Habermas has always tried to think of this conception of reason in terms of learning, as I've said, and he always, like the political and philosophical culture of the West, has overestimated the power of argument procedurally and conventionally understood to initiate new forms of learning. I have argued this in my book, Critique and Disclosure, and expressed a thought that we need more effective forms of learning than argument can provide, forms of learning in our political sphere, as well as in the intimate sphere, forms of learning which, because they engage us in grappling with what is unfamiliar and uncontrollable, with the obligation to begin anew, to speak and act differently, are far better and more promising vehicles of problem solving. I believe in problem solving, but I don't believe in procedures for solving a set of problems that cannot be solved by definition, by any procedure or set of rules. Drawing on the work of Heidegger, I propose practices of reflective disclosure as just such vehicles of learning. The term comes from Heidegger's notion of world disclosure, since it has taken me almost 300 pages to explain and justify what this means, and I'm still not quite sure myself. I don't expect successfully to convince you here of its importance in a few pages or a few minutes. You should read my book for that, and then you'll be really confused. However, I will briefly describe what it means. It is a two-level notion, referring first to the disclosure of conditions of intelligibility by which we have what we call a world in the first place. So it's a process that just happens, in a sense. For there to be intelligibility, we have to be thrown into a world which is already intelligible. We don't make it intelligible up here. We don't confront a bare world which is like raw data which we process in our minds like empiricist thought and which representationalist epistemology still believes, but rather we are always already in a world of intelligibility or meaning that is disclosed to us. But there's a second level of disclosure which involves not just our unreflective receptivity to these conditions of intelligibility, but rather involves our agency, our reflective disclosure. And here, what we are aiming for, because we are conscious of the limits of the conditions of intelligibility and possibility that we live with here and now, even though we don't know what lies beyond those limits, because we are conscious of the shortcomings of our current circumstances, we can disclose some alternative possibilities, not with confidence that they are right. It's not about anything, any process of epistemic certainty. We're construing them as possibilities. We do not know they're right. You can't know a possibility. A possibility is not an object of knowledge. It's something that can only be confirmed, verified in the future under appropriate conditions. So a reflective disclosure of the world aims to enlarge the cultural conditions of intelligibility and possibility by opening up new ways for us to go on together, new ways for us nonviolently to live together. When we forget that the world is a world that is first disclosed to us, when we forget that the world that is first disclosed to us is a disclosed world, our practices rigidify, become unfree, because this world, what we take to be now intelligible and possible, takes up all the space of possibility, precluding any intelligible alternative. And that is why our world, our practices, our cultural traditions, and so on, need to be redisclosed again and again. Currently, the whole world is going through complete panic because the system we thought, the economic system, the financial system, really, that we thought took care of everything for us in the well-off West, ain't working anymore. It has broken down in ways no one expected. And suddenly, things that were considered to be not only unintelligible, but completely stupid and backwards, such as running deficits deliberately, seem now to be the only smart thing we can do. But you back up 2 years and you will not find anyone on the left talking about running deficits. Anyone on the left, any left political party, would never publicly state that it would deliberately run a deficit to improve working conditions or the economy to ensure that this system doesn't fail or break down. But yet, all of a sudden, every major leader in the world, no matter which side of the political spectrum they represent, are talking about deficit economics, running a deficit. Now, you know, this is the kind of thing I mean. There can be a situation where we think something is patently absurd, an alternative is patently absurd for us, because we know from experience that that ain't going to fly. But then something happens, a breakdown, a crisis, and suddenly, oh, this possibility doesn't look nearly as unintelligible, and indeed, it looks downright attractive. So it's not, this is just to say that a lot of the vocabulary of my talk and my writing sounds like I'm some nutcase romantic, which I am, but there's a place for nutcase romantics. Without them, we're stuck with the vulgar is of the world. That's why I still love Kant. Now, so when we forget the world is a disclosed world, we let it dictate to us what our possibilities may be. But when we remember the world as a disclosed world, then we remember that it needs to be disclosed again and again. That there is never a time when we don't need a new beginning. Practices can take different forms, practices of reflective disclosure can take different forms and be oriented to the past, that is, retrieving some possibilities from the past that we have forgotten, dismissed, neglected, retrieving them and using them as semantic and conceptual sources for a new articulation of our practices. So reflective disclosure can be past-oriented, It can also be future-oriented, which means thinking about creative new beginnings, things that we don't already know. It's not like we're retrieving something and then kind of finding a way to get true to that again, but rather initiating a real break from what we have been, starting something new that was never done before, that we could never have imagined before. So it has both a orientation to the past and an orientation to the future. In either case, we're responding to the need for new meanings, new perspectives, new stances to the world. A need to reorient our institutions, redesign them, and in general, enlarging the conditions of intelligibility and possibility, allowing us to begin again and go on differently. We will always need to redisclose our practices, and never more so than when we believe that the current set of possibilities are all the possibilities that there are. It is in and through such practices of reflective disclosure that we can genuinely exercise our freedom, our political freedom, to initiate a new beginning for ourselves. I'm going to stop there because I went so slowly that there's no point in going on with the other stuff, because then there wouldn't be enough time for discussion. Thank you.
Okay, well, as is the custom, we'll take a 5-minute break, just to stretch your legs, comfort break, and then we'll regather and have our discussion.